KSVP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
In the hardest hit countries, a third or more of the adult population was infected with HIV and they were 100% were going to die.
The White House's rescission request proposes cuts for global health programs to control HIV and AIDS.
It's Wednesday, June 4th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, we speak to Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin.
He's called President Trump's massive tax bill immoral and grotesque.
We need to get off this unsustainable path, and the Big Beautiful Bill doesn't even begin to take us off this path.
And the Stanley Cup Final begins tonight, a matchup between the Florida Panthers and the Edmonton Oilers.
We typically don't see a lot of fights in the final either. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a couple guys dropping the gloves.
And writer Damon Young digs deep into Black American humor with a new essay collection.
Those stories and more after these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump's tariff hikes on imported steel and aluminum are now in effect, the administration upping the tariffs to 50% in a move that will potentially raise the cost of everything from automobiles to cans to paper clips. In an interview on NPR's All Things Considered, Martha Gimbel of Yale's Budget Lab explains.
We're now expecting car prices to go up by about 13% in the short run. It's going to be a pretty big hit for people, and cars are already an incredibly expensive purchase. So 13%, that's real money.
With the average price of a new car at just under $49,000 in May, tariffs could take the average new vehicle price well above $50,000. Higher tariffs are going to affect for most countries, though not at the moment for Britain, which has reached its own deal with the administration. Trump has argued the latest import taxes are necessary to protect U.S. industries. NATO defense ministers in some two dozen countries that support Ukraine met at alliance headquarters in Brussels. Terry Schultz reports U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, whose predecessor established the group, was not among them.
The U.S. abandoned chairing monthly meetings of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group after the inauguration of Donald Trump. Now, for the first time, a U.S. defense secretary didn't attend at all. NATO chief Mark Rutte was left trying to answer questions about what that might mean for the group that collects and coordinates military support for Ukraine.
The U.S. is completely committed to NATO, completely committed to our joint endeavors when it comes to Ukraine. There's no reason to doubt that.
Hegseth will join Thursday's meeting of defense ministers. They'll focus on approving the next set of NATO military obligations and a high U.S. priority on teeing up an agreement for all 32 countries to spend 5% of GDP on defense. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Hunters gathered today at the site of Sunday's attack in Boulder, Colorado, against a group raising awareness for hostages held in Gaza. From member station KUNC, Lucas Brady Woods reports.
It was an emotional scene with some attendees in tears as Colorado Governor Jared Polis, faith and community leaders addressed the crowd. They called for unity and for an end to anti-Semitism. Boulder Rabbi Mark Soloway said hate speech has eroded the safety of his community and many others.
Jews here and all over America and all over the world have not been feeling safe, not physically safe and not emotionally safe in the face of demonizing hate speech.
15 people were wounded in Sunday's attack. The suspect is facing federal hate crime and additional state charges. For NPR News, I'm Lucas Brady Woods in Boulder, Colorado.
Stocks recent run-up ran into a bit of a roadblock today with a mixed close on Wall Street. The Dow fell 91 points. The Nasdaq rose 61 points. The S&P 500 closed up a fraction at 5970. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. The U.S. Education Department is threatening Columbia University's accreditation, the latest salvo in the conflict between the Trump administration and elite colleges. The department's Office of Civil Rights sent a notice to the accrediting body that audits Columbia, saying the school is in violation of anti-discrimination laws and therefore fails to meet standards for accreditation. Columbia University has not responded to requests for comment. President Trump's plan to attend opening night of Les Mis at the Kennedy Center next week. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, the hub of Washington art scene has become unwittingly politicized.
President Trump is a big fan of Les Miserables. At campaign rallies, he used to make his entrance to one of its most stirring anthems blaring from loudspeakers. And the U.S. Army chorus recently performed it at the White House.
We'll
Since Trump abruptly ousted Kennedy Center leadership and disparaged past programming, several artists have canceled shows. And according to CNN, at least 10 members of the touring cast of Les Mis have decided not to appear in the Kennedy Center production. The president will be joined by the First Lady, Vice President J.D. Vance, and the Second Lady. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is taking steps to rename a Navy ship named for gay rights icon Harvey Milk. It's the latest move by Hegseth and the administration to purge what it considers to be diversity, equity, and inclusion references in the military. The USNS Harvey Milk is named for the slain gay rights activist who served as a sailor during the Korean War. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. In 2003, President George W. Bush went before Congress during the State of the Union address and talked about a global epidemic.
Today on the continent of Africa, nearly 30 million people have the AIDS virus, including 3 million children under the age of 15.
President Bush then announced PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. Late last year, the State Department said PEPFAR has saved 26 million lives and was working in 55 countries. Yesterday, the Trump White House asked Congress to take back funding it had previously approved in a process known as rescission. Most of these requests target foreign aid. That includes hundreds of millions of dollars for global health programs to control HIV/AIDS. Today, we reached Dr. Mark Dybul, the principal architect of PEPFAR, while he was at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He was later the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, and I asked him about the problem he and the Bush administration were trying to solve back in 2003.
It was absolutely catastrophic. In the hardest hit countries, a third or more of the adult population was infected with HIV, and they were 100% were going to die. In some districts, 75% of pregnant women were infected with HIV. And one thing people really didn't focus on much, because we're used to pandemics that affect very old and very young, is HIV somewhat uniquely kills the most productive and reproductive part of society. So it was devastating where you would have entire villages run by orphans because all the adults were gone. And the secondary part of that is a hopelessness. When you see everyone dying around you, you think you're going to die. And so why get a job or educated or take care of your children? And literally countries could have ceased to exist. Smaller countries that were heavily infected could have ceased to exist. That's how devastating it was.
You've spelled out quite clearly the why and the how much of all of this, but help us understand what exactly it was that PEPFAR has done on the ground, how easy it was, particularly in those early days, to implement.
Well, it was not easy. I have to say, President Bush had a vision that something needed to be done, and the moral imperative that this, it was unacceptable that we had drugs in the United States that were saving the lives of pretty much everyone who needed access to it. But people in Africa were going to die, and even though there was a treatment available. Now, one of the most important legacies of PEPFAR is not just the lives, it's the health systems that were built to deliver daily therapy. It's something that had never been done before. You need clinics to do that. You need a supply chain, logistics, communications. And those systems simply didn't exist in the way they needed to for chronic care. And so the systems that were built are remarkable and are there and are still not only for HIV, but they're being used to treat diabetes, hypertension, to respond to pandemics, to identify pandemics. Now, was it easy? It was extremely difficult. virtually everyone in the public health community said it was impossible to do and it wouldn't work. But it did. And it worked because the President of the United States stood up with strong bipartisan support to support countries to solve their problems at a national level. That's also something that had never been done before.
Just taking a step back for a second, I wonder, is there a story you might share or an example that sticks with you in the work that PEPFAR has done that speaks to the accomplishments and the effectiveness of PEPFAR?
One was in the early years. I was privileged to go to different clinics over time, and we were at one in rural Namibia, which is a small country that was heavily hit. 38% of the adult population was infected. And we went to a clinic and met a woman who had her small child with her. She was HIV positive when she delivered her child, and she named the child No Hope in the local language.
She named her child No Hope.
No Hope, because she had no hope. She was certain she was going to die and her child was going to die. But here she was, and here that child was, 4 years later, because of the support from the American people that provided the antiretroviral therapy to her, which prevented her child from actually getting the virus. It was a very beautiful and poignant moment.
Given what you've just said, what's lost in a world where PEPFAR isn't funded, in a world where potentially there is no PEPFAR?
Well, eventually we should be in a position where there is no PEPFAR, but it can't be done overnight. We haven't done the work on transition that needed to be done. And so there needs to be a paced reduction as we support the countries to have the ability to absorb the costs and find the efficiencies that they can within their systems. And to totally take them over and to crowd in the private sector, including our own private sector. It's just a matter of how long that should take and what the pace of reduction is, what we should be doing to support countries to achieve that transition. Global support will still be necessary in different ways, but not the way it is now.
I wonder if you can just spell out for us how PEPFAR has improved HIV and AIDS healthcare in Africa and across the globe. Give us a couple examples.
Well, 26 million people alive is a pretty good example. And I think a great way to think about that is when you meet young people or anyone in Africa today and ask them what are the 10 most important things of their lives, not one of them will say HIV. And we've done this. We've actually gone out and done this. And that's radically changed the economic potential. In fact, there are data that show that countries, again, that receive PEPFAR support have faster and higher GDPs than countries that did not. Countries that have received support from PEPFAR, including countries that were not fond of the United States at all, like Namibia because of our position on apartheid, completely changed the view of the United States because of PEPFAR. And that has a huge diplomatic dividend in a very complex world. But I think where you see it the most is in hope. There's hope for the continent. There's hope for the future. There's hope that their own lives will be fulfilled. And that's a beautiful thing. No one would any longer name their child No Hope.
Mark Dybul was the architect of PEPFAR in the George W. Bush administration, and he's currently a professor in the Department of Medicine and a senior advisor at the Center for Global Health Practice and Impact at Georgetown University. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for focusing on a very important area.
In hockey, there's this idea that stars have to lose a Stanley Cup before they can win one. That's the path some hockey greats have taken, like Wayne Gretzky and Sidney Crosby. Now, this era's biggest talent has a shot to follow in those footsteps when the Stanley Cup final begins tonight. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan's here in the studio. Hey, Becky.
Hello, Ari.
Okay, this Stanley Cup final is between the Florida Panthers and the Edmonton Oilers, and the star we're talking about is Connor McDavid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is the best player in hockey. He's just like a transcendent player. And I think so good that you don't have to be a hockey fan to be able to identify him. When you turn on an Oilers game, you will instantly know who we're talking about. Number 97 in the orange and blue, 28-year-old star, widely considered the best player of this current generation.
What's so great about him?
Well, his puck skills are insane. He's incredibly fast on the ice and can deft with the puck. He's incredible both at scoring, creating opportunities for his teammates. And I actually think the main thing that sort of elevates him to superstar is the intangible part, which is that he always seems to be able to put his mark on a game when it's needed from him. And so this is how Eddie Olczyk put it. He's a longtime NHL player who's now an analyst for TNT.
Honestly, I get the same feeling that I get when I watch Patrick Mahomes down in a football game, time coming down, he has the ball, you just know he's going to score. I get that same feeling when Michael would get the ball that the Bulls were going to win.
And so, you know, this guy, Connor McDavid, he's won essentially every significant individual award that you can name in hockey, but his name isn't on the Stanley Cup. He might be the best player to ever play hockey whose name isn't there. So it's kind of the last remaining knock against him.
The Florida Panthers stand in his way. He's with the Oilers. This is a rematch. What should we expect?
Yeah, rematch of last year, as you said. That was an incredibly thrilling series. It went all the way to 7 games. The Panthers won the first 3 games. It seemed like, wow, they were going to sweep. What a breeze to the Stanley Cup. But instead, the Oilers, led by McDavid, won Game 4. Then they won Game 5. Then they won Game 6. And it was like, oh, man, these guys might pull off this historic comeback, force this dramatic winner-take-all Game 7, which the Panthers won. So obviously, Florida is a great team. This is actually the 3rd year in a row they've reached the Stanley Cup final. They lost that first year, then won last year, led by star Matthew Tkachuk, who has been a big name in NHL circles for a while, but really kind of burst into more of a household name status outside of hockey this past February with the Four Nations face-off, where he was the sort of star big player for USA in those fun, tense games against Canada. And that Canadian team, of course, featured Connor McDavid, by the way. So lots of history there.
Does all this history make it a better watch or more of like a rerun?
Oh, I think a better watch. I mean, there's all sorts of ways that a rematch, I think, make it kind of easier on the guys. Like, there was this big media day yesterday where players mentioned some of these things, like Edmonton to Miami. That's a very long flight. That was kind of a shock to the system last year. I think those guys are used to it now. But also
the humidity.
Exactly. But also there is this emotional aspect. That is what Anson Carter told me about. He is a TNT analyst who played in the NHL for 11 seasons. Like, the Oilers, that's a lot that you have to put into coming back, trying to come back to win the 7-game series. They were gutted, devastated when they lost that final game. Carter says those emotions don't just disappear.
We typically don't see a lot of fights in the final either. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a couple guys dropping the gloves. They saw each other last year. Yeah, there's a lot of turnover, but there's a lot of guys still back that felt that pain.
So, you know, we're not condoning fights here on NPR, but emotions,
to be clear,
investment, that is what makes sports of any kind fun to watch. And so I think you have all of that context going into this. I think it's going to be a great matchup.
Who's going to win?
Okay, we can't do that to me. Last time this went to 7 games, it's impossible to say, but I'll tell you what I am hoping for, which is more close games, more dramatic outcomes, mm-hmm. great play by the stars. What else can you ask for?
Way to dodge the question. Becky Sullivan, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. During the more than 600 days of war in Gaza, there has been a steady chorus of Israelis clamoring for their leaders to strike a deal with Hamas. Many Israelis have been loud and unabashed about their push to end the war, to ensure the return of the hostages held by militants in Gaza. But as casualties mount and food is being greatly restricted into the enclave, public discourse has been changing. Speaking out about the plight of Palestinians in Gaza is becoming less taboo. NPR's Hadil El-Shalchi reports.
A small but noisy group of protesters are penned behind a metal fence encircled by Israeli police near the border with Gaza, just on the other side of a dusty hill. People chanted slogans to end the war in Gaza and waved Israeli flags. The protest is organized by a left-wing Israeli peace group, but not everyone here is a veteran activist. 68-year-old Esti Cohen bangs on an empty cooking pot, she says, to highlight hunger in Gaza. She says right after the Hamas-led attack on Israel on October 7th in 2023, she was all for an Israeli response. But as the war drags on, she says it's gone too far.
We heard the children are dying because of lack of food, and I cannot agree. I can't accept it.
Cohen took a bus for 4 hours to get to the border protest. Sully Abraham lives nearby but isn't a regular at these events. He too thought it was right to fight after the Hamas attack, but not anymore.
Children are getting dead over there. We want our hostages to be home. And all the situation right now is not really contributing to this, to bring them home.
The anti-war sentiment in Israel has largely been driven by the desire to get the hostages back home. Now at demonstrations, though, you can see Israelis carrying pictures of Palestinian children who were killed, as well as signs with slogans to end genocide, a charge Israel is disputing at a UN court in The Hague. And now prominent Israeli politicians are calling out Israel's conduct, like centrist politician and a former Israeli military chief of staff, Moshe Ya'alon. In an interview last month, Ya'alon accused the government of sending the Israeli military into Gaza to commit war crimes. And Yair Golan, a left-wing opposition leader and former deputy chief of staff in the Israeli military, told Israeli public media that the country was becoming a pariah state. A sane state does not wage war against civilians, does not kill babies as a hobby, and does not set goals for itself like the expulsion of a population, Golan said. Left-leaning journalist Meron Rapaport says hearing this rhetoric from politicians is giving more Israelis the freedom to speak out themselves.
As the images coming out of Gaza of starvation, of children dying of hunger, and of course, change of public opinion in the West.
Which has hit home for many, he says. For the first time, strong allies of Israel are threatening to punish it, even withhold economic cooperation. But the shift in discourse is nuanced and finding its footing. In a recent survey commissioned by Pennsylvania State University, 82% of Israeli Jews polled said they supported the expulsion of Palestinians from Gaza. Even leftist politician Golan backtracked his comments about killing as a hobby after some public backlash, including some members of the Israeli military. And there are those who want the war to continue, like the father of Itan Mor, still being held hostage in Gaza. Tzvika Mor was recently in Jerusalem, lobbying lawmakers. He says fighting Hamas is the only way to free his son. We don't want to kill babies. We want to maintain our security, he says. If to protect our babies, we have to kill the enemy, then that's what we'll do, Moore says. For now, Moore's stance is the Israeli government's policy: to press on with the war despite the high Palestinian death toll, even as the anti-war voices get bolder. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The Trump administration appears to have stepped up the criminal background checks of legal permanent residents as they re-enter the country. That's led to some high-profile detentions and removals. And as NPR's Martin Costi reports, those cases have many green card holders wondering if they should risk leaving the country at all.
Outside the ICE detention center in Tacoma, Washington last week, a rare display of joy. Family and friends celebrated the release of Llewellyn Dixon, a 64-year-old Filipina who'd been locked up for almost 3 months since her arrest at the Seattle airport.
I love you so much.
Dixon has lived in the U.S. for half a century, and she has deep roots here, which helped her during her detention.
Thank you. Thank you for the letters. Thank you for the prayers. Thank you so much.
So why would a permanent resident so connected to her American community be arrested coming back into the country? Her immigration attorney is Benjamin Osorio.
So she has an old conviction from 2001.
Dixon was caught stealing on the job. She did time in a halfway house and then put the matter behind her. Legally, though, that criminal record jeopardized her green card status. But it didn't come up, even when she traveled overseas, until this year.
We're in a maximum enforcement era now, right, where the goal is to pick up as many people and charge as many people and put as many people in removal proceedings and ultimately deport as many people as possible.
He convinced an immigration judge to let Dixon back into the country based on her clean record in more recent years, and now she plans to apply for citizenship. Osorio says he never used to get cases like this since he started practicing immigration law 12 years ago. Now he's had three more like this since February. And some say this tougher enforcement is overdue.
You know, it shouldn't be the case that once you get a green card, you're in home free.
Jessica Vaughn is with the Center for Immigration Studies, which supports President Trump's immigration enforcement policies.
If you do something after getting a green card that disqualifies you, well, that should be looked at and enforced.
NPR asked the administration if it's telling border officers to be stricter when checking the backgrounds of permanent residents. In a written statement, Customs and Border Protection replied, quote, "The Trump administration is enforcing immigration laws, something the previous administration failed to do," end quote. As a result, worried green card holders are now flocking to immigration attorneys such as Michael Catagliotti.
In the cases of folks who have arrest records or encounters with law enforcement, the first question is always, you know, can I expunge it? Can I wipe it out? Like, what wouldn't that save me? It's not really. They'll still be able to see it.
And he says where before immigration officers may have let an old criminal record slide, green card holders can't count on that now.
The safest thing, obviously, unfortunately, is to not travel, to have a plan, whether it be an attorney, whether it be an accountant, a friend, a family member. It doesn't really matter. That's just something that a lot of folks are asking me for.
It is important to point out here that only a fraction of 1% of the 13 million green card holders have been refused re-entry to the U.S. this way. But attorney Benjamin Osorio says when it happens, it can take people by surprise. He says often a single criminal incident is not enough to get you deported, but it can keep you from being allowed back in. And that means some green card holders find out there's a problem only when they're trying to come back home. Martin Costi, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The United States is cracking down on international students, and fewer international students seem interested in paying American universities to attend. So where would they go instead?
In the short term, the UK will undoubtedly benefit, but in the long term, the cause of global research may very well suffer.
Why students may flock to Britain on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Damon Young pulled together a group of fellow writers for a Black humor anthology. By that, he means humor coming from Black American voices.
My only directive for people was to be funny. And it wasn't necessarily like, okay, be funny, haha, tell knock-knock jokes. It was like, you know what, be yourself.
Now the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The United States has vetoed a resolution that called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. It was the lone no vote as other UN Security Council members raised alarms about starvation in Gaza. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has more.
The 10 non-permanent members of the Security Council drafted the resolution because of what Slovenia's ambassador called a deep concern over the catastrophic situation in Gaza. It called on Hamas to release hostages and says Israel should allow aid to reach starving Palestinians. U.S. Ambassador Dorothy Shea says there were no real negotiations on the text, calling the vote performative.
U.S. opposition to this resolution should come as no surprise. It is unacceptable for what it does say. It is unacceptable for what it does not say.
She says the council should condemn Hamas and tell it to disarm and agree to a ceasefire. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro is suing the Department of Agriculture over its attempt to cancel a national food purchasing program. The Democratic governor fighting for $13 million that was slated for Pennsylvania farms this year. Jackson White reports.
The Local Food Purchase Assistance Cooperative Agreement aids states in buying food from local farms to give to schools, childcare facilities, and food banks. In March, the USDA told Shapiro's administration that it planned to cancel the food program because it no longer aligned with the agency's priorities. Now, after months of trying to get USDA funds for the program, Governor Shapiro says Pennsylvania is taking the agency to court.
We have exhausted all options to be able to resolve this matter simply through dialogue. And I'm tired of waiting for someone to stand up for our farmers and our food banks. That task falls to us.
The USDA declined to comment on the pending litigation. For NPR News, I'm Jackson White in Harrisburg.
This is NPR. In Saudi Arabia, officials say more than 2 million people are performing the Islamic Hajj pilgrimage in and around Mecca today, where temperatures were in the triple digits. NPR's Eyya Betraoui reports this surpasses last year's number of pilgrims who took part.
The Hajj pilgrimage draws Muslims from around the world to Saudi Arabia each year. It's one of the largest and most logistically challenging gatherings of people anywhere. Last year, at least 1,300 people died of heat exhaustion at the Hajj. Saudi authorities say they've installed more shaded walkways and water coolers around the Hajj this year. Tens of thousands of medics are also on hand to assist. Most of the people who died last year from the heat did not have authorized visas or adequate accommodation. Saudi authorities say in the lead up to this year's Hajj, they turned away 269,000 people without authorized permits. Many save up for a lifetime to afford the journey to Mecca and wait for years for their turn to secure the visa. Muslims believe completing the Hajj can wipe away past sins. Eyya Betraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
A Washington state man has been arrested as an alleged accomplice in last month's bombing of a fertility clinic in Palm Springs, California. Authorities say 32-year-old Daniel Park is accused of supplying hundreds of pounds of ammonium nitrate to the bomber who killed himself outside of that clinic. Prosecutors say Park and the bomber, Guy Bartkus, had similar extremist beliefs. Park allegedly fled to Poland after the bombing and was arrested there and sent back to the U.S. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Immoral, grotesque, those are some of the words that Republican Senator Ron Johnson has used to describe the massive tax bill President Trump has made a top priority. Johnson's comments come the same week as top Trump ally Elon Musk has expressed his disdain for the president's proposed spending agenda. A lot is riding on this bill, which would, among other things, cut taxes, change federal food benefits, and put work requirements on Medicaid, among many, many other things. It narrowly squeaked through the House, and Trump says he wants to sign the bill by July 4th. But fiscal hawks, like Johnson, have serious concerns about how much it would add to the federal deficit. $2.4 trillion, according to a report released today by the Congressional Budget Office. So, with negotiations currently underway in the Senate and the president hitting a wall with some in his own party, what can Trump do to get his bill to the finish line? To help answer the question, we called up Senator Ron Johnson. I asked him what some of his non-negotiables are.
The goal should have been, how do we bend the deficit curve down rather than allow it to skyrocket? This bill allows it to skyrocket. It doesn't really make a dent in that reality, and that's unfortunate. So you need to go back to the drawing board. As I've been writing about since January, we need to return to a reasonable pre-pandemic level spending. The only way that's going to happen is we have to do the work. We have to go line by line through the federal budget, program by program, over 2,600 programs, federal government, do forensic audits, expose the waste, fraud, and abuse like DOGE did in their short-term effort here. We went from $4.4 trillion spending in 2019 to over $7 trillion. I have to believe if we actually look at this and we haven't taken the time or done the work to do so, you will literally find hundreds of billions of dollars of spending that if we eliminate, nobody would even notice other than the grifters who are sucking down the waste, fraud, and abuse.
Senator, President Trump, however, is pushing for this bill to go forward. He wants to see it passed. Do you think deep down President Trump cares about deficits?
Well, I'm going to take him at his word. He promised during his State of the Union that he was going to do for the first time in 24 years, balance the federal budget. Well, in order to do that, you have to at least see deficits reducing over time.
Why do you think he's pushing for this bill forward? Why do you think he leaned on House Republicans to pass it, given all of that?
Well, again, I appreciate the fact that he's focusing on working men and women with his tax proposals. He wants to honor those promises. I respect that. He made these promises to the campaign. But, you know, he's running into a Senate, at least populated by people like me, who ran as a Tea Party candidate, saying that mortgaging our children's future is wrong and immoral. Back then, it was $14 trillion in debt. Now we're $37 trillion on a path to $60 trillion within the next 10 years. So we need to get off this unsustainable path. And the big, beautiful bill doesn't even begin to take us off this path.
How relevant to you is Elon Musk in all of this? We saw his criticism pretty notable, given how close he was with President Trump, calling it a, quote, disgusting abomination, saying this would drive the country into, quote, debt slavery. How politically relevant is Elon Musk in this moment as you and other Senate Republicans are looking at this legislation?
Well, I think people recognize him as a very smart individual who did a fabulous job with DOGE, exposing waste, fraud, and abuse, understands numbers, and now he's stepped away from the administration. He's basically doing what I'm doing. He's telling people the truth.
Do you think that hurts President Trump, that somebody who's such a high-profile part of this administration is using those terms to criticize his signature bill?
No, again, I think we all support President Trump, and we want to see him succeed. And the only way we succeed is we have to get this debt and deficit under control. The one big beautiful bill isn't doing it. So again, I'm just talking about reality. I'm putting aside the rhetoric, the slogans, and I'm focusing on the substance and the reality. And the reality is quite grim.
Can the bill pass right now in the Senate?
No, it won't.
Do you think leadership understands that, or do you think this? How much? I guess let me ask it this way: how much pressure are you getting from the majority leader in the White House right now?
Not much. I've been talking about this since January. I've been warning them, this doesn't have a chance of passing. And I don't think it does. So, you know, time to retool. They say that these multiple bills, that ship has sailed. Well, call those ships back to port. You know, we have to do this in multiple steps. We can't put this country on a more sustainable path in one giant bill. It's, you know, the House just proved that. Their bill does not put us on a sustainable path. It doesn't even make a dent in it.
That's interesting to me, though, that you're not, it seems like you're not, when you say you're not getting much pressure, you're not getting direct calls from the White House, from the Majority Leader's office saying, hey, how can you get on board?
Well, I got a very nice call from the president on Monday. We agreed to work together, hone our numbers, you know, so we're at least, you know, talking on the same page here. That's what I'm doing right now. So I'm out there in the public. I'm laying out the reality. I'm talking numbers that are indisputable, but describe our situation as grim and unsustainable, as opposed to, you know, talking about one big beautiful bill and getting it passed by July. And again, that's all rhetoric. That's just slogans. I'm focusing on substance, which they're going to have a hard time refuting and disputing.
What was his response on the phone when you raised these concerns and framed this again, his signature piece of legislation, in the stark way you're talking about it?
Well, again, he points out that we have to do something. We do. So, again, we have to avoid a massive automatic tax increase. Completely agree with that. We're going to have to increase the debt ceiling. I've never voted for one, but I will this time. We need the funds for securing the border. We should bank whatever savings the House has come up with. They've done a lot of good work there. So, you know, total agreement that we have to do something. I'm willing to do it. I'm just not willing to vote as this is the only – this can't be our only bite at the apple here. And right now, if we try and pass this, our moment will pass. We will have blown our opportunity. So we've got to do this in multiple stages. I've been supportive of that. That's what Leader Thune wanted to do. I think within the Senate, we've always thought this should be a multiple-step process. You know, Speaker Johnson and President Trump thought otherwise. I think we'll probably prove the fact that it's the only way it's going to get done is multiple steps. Again, so the sooner they recognize that reality, I want to work with them. I want to see him succeed. I'm a big supporter of President Trump. So,
Senator, I want to ask about one other aspect of this bill that's gotten a lot of political attention. You represent a big agriculture state. This is also a state where 700,000 people rely on SNAP benefits, which are called food share in Wisconsin. You know, the analysis of this House bill is a lot of people would lose those benefits if that program goes back to being fully funded by states. Is that a political outcome or a policy outcome that you would be on board with?
We want people to get good paying jobs so they can support themselves. Work requirements worked wonderfully under Bill Clinton. He embraced them. We need to re-embrace these things and get people jobs so that they're off of welfare. So they're not dependent on the federal government. That's not good for them. That's not certainly good for the federal budget.
But you should work requirements. But if the funding for this changed and if that led to a drastically smaller program, that's something you'd be comfortable with?
Again, it will drastically reduce because we'll have work requirements and people will actually go back to work. That's been the history of this. It worked in the past. It will work in the future as well.
Lastly, you've seen how the politics works in the Republican Party in the first Trump administration and now as well. There's an incredibly powerful force in Republican primary politics where if you're not with the president, you get primaried and you often lose. I don't believe you're on the ballot this cycle. Is that something that helps you take this stand right now?
Well, again, I promised in 2010 I would always tell my constituents the truth and I'd never vote and by extension conduct myself with re-election in mind. So I'm focused on our children, our grandchildren. The immorality of us mortgaging their future and making it worse and worse rather than better. So that's my loyalty is to our kids and grandkids, to America as we know it. This is unsustainable.
That is Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin. Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
President Trump wants a smaller government workforce, and in his first 4 months, he's tried many things to achieve that. But how many people has he actually gotten out of government so far? As NPR's Andrea Hsu reports, it's hard to say.
A couple weeks ago, a special visitor to the White House put a version of that question to Trump's press secretary, Caroline Leavitt.
Bobby Lynn?
How many people has he fired?
It was Bring Your Child to Work Day.
How many people has he fired?
And this child got a lesson in political spin.
Thus far, actually, we have not had anyone fired with the exception of one individual who did leave their job.
In fact, President Trump has fired quite a number of people, members of independent agencies, a bunch of inspectors general, even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now, what is true is that many more people have left their jobs, most of them in exchange for pay and benefits through September. Here's how Trump put it last week.
More than 75,000 bureaucrats have voluntarily left their taxpayer-funded jobs.
Many people told NPR they didn't want to quit, but did so because they feared being fired if they stayed. And by the way, that 75,000 number Trump mentioned is from February. It's likely several times larger by now. Even with agencies like USAID, which Trump has essentially dismantled, it's hard to say how many people are gone. That's because much of what Trump has done, halting its work and freezing international aid grants, has been challenged in court.
Most employees, I believe, are on some type of paid leave.
Sky Perryman is president of Democracy Forward. That's a legal organization that has filed scores of lawsuits trying to stop Trump's actions. And so far, anyway, they've had some success. In one big case, a federal judge in San Francisco halted the mass layoffs at about 20 different agencies, including ones like Health and Human Services, which had already told 10,000 people they were losing their jobs. Perryman says Trump can slash the workforce, but the way he's doing it is illegal.
So if you are going to decimate agencies that are fulfilling a purpose, a lawful purpose that Congress has mandated, that requires congressional approval.
And Trump had not gotten that. Now his administration is asking the Supreme Court to intervene. But for now, his hopes for cuts of 40 to 50% at many agencies are on hold. And also on hold is a lot of the work that people were doing, as thousands of them are now being paid to stay home. And then there are people in an even more bizarre state of limbo.
My name is Lauren Duick, and I was the director of communications at NOAA's satellite division.
That's part of the Department of Commerce. Duick and hundreds of other probationary employees or more recent hires were fired in late February and early March, but then reinstated under court order and then fired again when an appeals court lifted that order. Now that court is still considering whether the firings were legal. Meanwhile, nobody, Duick knows, has gotten paperwork showing they've been terminated.
It's been almost 2 months, and no one has seen any progress on getting this paperwork done.
Duick says that's kept some people from getting new health insurance, collecting unemployment, even starting a new job.
We've been calling regularly. Lots of different people have called many times to try and get them to answer any of these questions.
The Commerce Department did not respond to NPR's questions about what's going on here either.
If they're gonna fire us, at least just fire us. Like, let us go on and move on to other things.
Like finding a new job with less uncertainty. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. What do you do if you hear from someone about a really difficult life moment? Losing a mother, a baby, facing completely unfair treatment at work. What do you do with those stories? If you're Damon Young, you probably put them together in a collection of comedic essays.
This was me just trying to reach out to people who represent, I guess, the expansiveness, you know, the virtuosity, the range of Black humor.
To be clear, when he says Black humor, he is not talking about heavy or taboo topics. He means humor coming specifically from Black American voices. Damon Young is a columnist, culture blog founder, and podcast host, among many things. And he tapped fellow writers, including Roy Wood Jr., Clover Hope, Wyatt Cenac, and many, many more for a new anthology called That's How They Get You.
My only directive for people was to be funny. And it wasn't necessarily like, okay, be funny, haha, tell knock knock jokes. It's like, you know what, be yourself. And because I know who you are and I know what you're capable of, I know that you're going to be funny.
I asked Young more about the impetus for this new collection and why the stories can feel universal no matter where we grew up.
The premise of my intro is that Black American humor is the best American humor. And I believe that because I believe that we have to be the most honest about America, about who America is, what America is, you know, and when you are, when you're people who has been vulnerable the entire time, right, you pay closer attention. And I think that that sort of clarity, that sort of honesty, that sort of like reckoning, the best humor comes from that.
I never like to ask people to pick favorites because it's like picking your favorite child, and that is unfair.
Mine.
But...
if you're asking my favorite essays, I'm going to say mine.
It's Come yours. On. All right. Tell us about
Come
it.
On,
tell the people about it.
Okay. I mean, so I originally, it's about my relationship with my teeth. Mm-hmm. And it's a maybe 1,800 word long sentence. I wanted to take the reader into the stream of consciousness that I experience when I'm thinking about my teeth. I'm thinking about the relationship with shame. I'm thinking about, you know, the relationship with class and getting Invisalign and then leaving the house the first time with my Invisalign. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, can I smile? Can I take a selfie now? Can I do all this, all these things that I was gun shy about mm-hmm. before? But okay, if the answer to the question that you were going to ask.
You think you know the question I was going to ask. Well, here's the thing, though. I wonder, like, you've got all of these amazing contributors who have written. And is there one submission that you either opened up in your inbox or picked up the paper and you were like, this is just so dang funny. It has to be in here.
Well, I think an essay like Hillary Cross the Coker's, right, where she writes about, and Hillary's a great friend of mine, mm-hmm. where she writes about having a miscarriage.
Yeah.
And it's also... weirdly an essay about marriage is that it's about the miscarriage is kind of the plot, but the marriage is the story.
Yeah.
And that essay just blew me away.
There's this moment that stuck with me where she's writing about how she is still having this miscarriage. Her husband is useless to her because he's hurt himself. Her colleagues are doing their normal whatever it is they're doing at work, and yet she is still enduring and showing up.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about our humor that can be such a salve when we're talking about and living with the humor that can come through something as deeply painful as a miscarriage?
I mean, I think it's just, it's a necessity. It's a necessity that is just born out of our experience. And it's like, yeah, true. Okay, whatever. But I still have to live. I still have to go to work. I still have to be a present partner. I still have to be a good friend. And I still have to laugh. I still have to find the humor. And again, it's not even necessarily finding the humor. The humor is there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, you know, whether or not you choose to acknowledge it.
I want to ask you about one of my favorite essays, and it's the essay by Dee Watkins. Dee is talking about changing his little girl's diaper and his role as a father. And then he kind of starts meditating on his dad, who struggled with addictions over the years. But he's talking about how he still really loves him and thought his dad was amazing. And then he raises this question of, like, what will my daughter think of me when I grow up? And I know that, Damon, you are a dad, right?
I am a dad, yes.
How much of that goes through your head? That just felt so relatable when I read it, that, like, how do I measure up? Like,
what is she going to think when she's my age and I'm sitting in a rocking chair somewhere?
I'm terrified of that thought. You know, I have two kids now, a 9-year-old and 6-year-old, and it's like I don't want to do a thing that they're talking about in therapy, right, 25 years later. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that is that's an anchoring and animating sort of fear, anxiety, right? Because you don't want to mess your kids up, but we have to figure that out somehow. And again, I really love Dee's work. I really love his perspective. And I thought that, you know, him writing about his experience as a parent, there's so much humor to mine out of parenthood. You know, my son says something and I ask him, excuse me, and he says, I wasn't talking to you, Daddy. And it's like, okay, what am I supposed to do with this? Because it's true. He's telling the truth. But this is you don't say, I'm not talking to you, Daddy. You, okay, there's another way to express that without, well, I'll hurt my feelings, right?
You know, I want to ask you, I was reading an interview you did about this collection with the Pittsburgh City Paper, and you made the point that one of the recurring themes that you find across all of these essays and all of the parts of this collection is shame. Can you say more about that?
So I just had a residency at the University of Pittsburgh. It was a 2-year stint. You know, the first thing that I told students is that I want you to extract whatever shames you feel about your background, about your personalities, about all these things that make you, right? Because the best humor comes from an exploration of all those things. It comes from the weird. And the thing is, shame is tricky because the people who don't feel it are the ones who probably need to feel it the most, right? The people who move through life without the capacity for shame should probably feel some shame. And then you have people who feel shame about, you know, growing up poor or maybe not being able-bodied or all these other things that maybe they didn't have much control over. And this collection is, you know, is an example of that, right? Where, you know, these generous geniuses decided to, you know, dive into their vulnerabilities for this collection. And I'm just greatly appreciative that so many people were willing to go there with stuff that, you know, maybe wasn't comfortable to share, stuff that maybe they hadn't shared with other people before.
We've been speaking with Damon Young, editor of That's How They Get You, an unruly anthology of Black American humor. It's out now. Damon, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And for
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.